The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Late Rome, a warning model topic. Introduction. When people hear the phrase Fall of Rome, they often picture a sudden crash. One dramatic defeat, one final emperor, and then an empire disappears. History is almost never that neat. Rome matters because it shows something more difficult and more useful to study. Large states usually weaken through a long chain of pressures that build, interact, and sometimes reinforce one another. Political legitimacy frays. Fiscal burdens rise. Military demands intensify. Administration becomes harder to coordinate. Social trust thins. None of those problems has to be fatal on its own, but together they can change the fate of an entire civilization. That is why Rome still belongs in serious study now. It is not simply a story about the distant ancient world. It is a disciplined way to think about how institutions hold together, how they fail, and how they sometimes adapt under stress. In this lecture, Rome is not a prophecy for the modern United States, and it is not a slogan. It is a warning model. That distinction matters. The point is not to say that America is Rome in disguise. The point is to ask what happens when a powerful society begins to strain under problems that interact instead of arriving one at a time. This lecture is for listeners who want more than a simplified historical legend. It is written for advanced high school students, college newcomers, curious adults, and anyone who wants a clearer grasp of how historians reason from evidence. You do not need specialized training to follow the argument. What you do need is a willingness to think carefully about terms like legitimacy, civil-military relations, fiscal capacity, administrative fragmentation, and social cohesion. Those ideas may sound technical, but they describe everyday realities of government and public life. A state survives not only by having laws and armies, but by convincing people that the laws deserve obedience, the armies are governed, the money system works, and common burdens are still shareable. We begin with late antiquity, because that is the best frame for understanding Rome's transformation. The Western Empire does not simply vanish in one moment. It moves through crisis, reform, reorganization, bargaining, and decline in authority. Some institutions harden, others weaken. Some survive only by becoming something different. Once that larger pattern is clear, the old question changes shape. The important issue is no longer what single thing caused Rome to fall. The better question is, how do several forms of strain begin to damage one another? And what does a state do when its usual solutions create new vulnerabilities? That question gives the whole lecture its tension. First, we build the historical foundation and learn how to read the period without myth or exaggeration. Then we examine the major forces at work in Rome's weakening and compare them, carefully and without flattening the differences, to present-day America. Finally, we turn from diagnosis to prevention and ask what institutional resilience requires when trust, coordination, and burden-sharing begin to erode. The goal is not to induce panic, and it is not to offer easy optimism. The goal is to develop a clearer, more disciplined way of seeing how complex systems endure, falter, and sometimes recover. So as we begin, keep one guiding question in mind. When do problems remain separate, and when do they link up into a feedback loop that becomes much harder to stop? Rome is valuable because it shows that the answer to that question can determine the future of a state. The same question, asked with care, can also sharpen our understanding of the modern world. End of introduction. When people hear the phrase Fall of Rome, they often imagine a single catastrophic moment, a final blow, and then darkness. Modern historians usually treat the topic differently. The weakening of late Roman power is better understood as a long process with many causes. It unfolds over generations, not in one day, one battle, or one ruler's failure. That is why the period from the late 3rd through the 5th centuries of the Common Era remains one of the most studied transformations in history. It offers a rich case study of how a large and powerful state can come under pressure for several directions at once, adapt and survive for a time, and then change form in ways that are partly managed and partly forced. In this lecture, we take the Roman experience seriously, while keeping our comparison disciplined. Rome functions here as a structured warning model, not as a prophecy, and not as a claim that the United States is simply Rome in modern dress. The goal is not to predict a replay. The goal is to examine how complex institutions behave when legitimacy, military power, fiscal capacity, administrative coordination, and social cohesion begin to strain each other. To make that manageable, it helps to start with a framing term. Historians often use the phrase late antiquity. It describes the long age of transformation that runs from the late Roman imperial world toward the post-Roman order. In plain terms, late antiquity is the stretch of time when the old Roman system is still recognizably present, but it is being reorganized under pressure. The term is useful because it pushes against an overly simple story of sudden collapse. It directs attention to transition, reconfiguration, and uneven change. Some institutions harden, some weaken, some survive only by becoming something different. The West does not simply disappear all at once. Political authority, military organization, taxation, regional power, and social obligations shift over time. Once this is clear, the familiar question of Rome's fall becomes less a search for one decisive cause, and more an investigation into interacting stress pathways. Several core concepts make the rest of the analysis easier to follow. The first is imperial legitimacy. Legitimacy is the perceived right of a ruler and a state to command obedience. In Roman terms, that means more than formal office. It means that people across the empire accept, however reluctantly, that imperial orders carry rightful force. Taxes are due. Laws can be enforced. Officials may punish, and the state may demand sacrifice in money, labor, service, and sometimes life itself. A government can compel obedience through fear, but no large state can run on fear alone. It needs enough acceptance that daily administration remains possible. Once legitimacy begins to weaken, the cost of governing rises. More energy goes into coercion, bargaining, exemption, and crisis management. Less energy goes into ordinary rule. The second concept is civil-military relations. This refers to the balance between political authority and armed force. In any state, military power must be governed without being allowed to govern everything. In the late Roman world, this balance becomes especially fragile. Armies stationed in different regions can elevate commanders, support usurpers, or withdraw support from sitting rulers. When that happens, generals cease to be merely instruments of the state. They become political actors who can make or unmake emperors. That creates a deep institutional problem. If rulers depend on armies for accession and survival, the army is not only defending the system, it is also shaping who controls it. Even when no one intends to overthrow anyone, dependence can pull politics toward repeated testing of force. The third concept is the fiscal military state. This phrase describes a political order in which taxation, supply systems, coinage, logistics, and administration exist to a very large extent in service of military security. Rome is not only a war machine. It governs cities, enforces law, arbitrates disputes, and sustains imperial prestige. Yet in late imperial conditions, defense becomes so central that fiscal structures and administrative machinery are constantly bent toward raising revenue, provisioning forces, moving supplies, and holding frontiers. That means fiscal strain is never just an economic problem. It is also a strategic problem. If revenue falters, the army suffers. If military demands rise, taxation and administration intensify. Pressure in one area migrates quickly into the others. The fourth concept is administrative fragmentation. This does not simply mean that official borders vanish. It means political power gradually reorients around regions, commanders, local elites, and competing chains of authority. Orders still issue from the center, but their practical force becomes less uniform. Regional military leaders gain leverage. Local magnates become more important. Courts, provinces, and logistical zones develop interests of their own. The result is not always open secession. Often it is something subtler and more corrosive. Authority becomes layered, negotiated, and inconsistent. Instead of one clear chain of command, there are many partial lines of influence, and the system pays a coordination cost every time a crisis demands a fast, unified response. The fifth concept is foederati. This term is used by historians for treaty-bound or allied non-Roman groups that receive land, subsidies, status, or recognition in exchange for military service or political cooperation. These groups occupy a mixed position. They are not simply outside invaders, and they are not simply Roman troops. In the short term, such arrangements can solve immediate manpower and security problems. They can also shift coercive power away from direct imperial control. Over time, the center can become increasingly dependent on negotiated relationships rather than on its own fully integrated command structures. One more idea sits beside these terms because it drives many of them at once. Succession. Who becomes emperor, by what recognized rule, and with whose backing, is never a minor procedural matter in Rome. It is a central institutional problem. Stable systems usually need a widely accepted way to transfer supreme power. When that mechanism is weak, every succession becomes a test of force, persuasion, coalition building, and luck. Roman history offers recurring evidence that uncertain succession encourages coups, civil wars, elite hedging, and military intervention in politics. It also poisons expectations. Elites do not only plan for the future outcome, they plan for the moment when power might change hands. Uncertainty about who rules next shapes behavior right now, not just after a transition. With those concepts in place, the late Roman timeline becomes easier to read. A useful baseline begins with the crisis of the 3rd century. This is a period marked by repeated usurpation, civil war, frontier pressure, fiscal strain, and temporary fragmentation of imperial authority. The empire does not face one challenge at a time. Rulers rise and fall quickly. Commanders are proclaimed by troops. Rival claimants divide loyalty. Frontiers demand defense, while internal conflict consumes resources. Administrative continuity is stressed by violent turnover at the top. In a system already burdened by succession uncertainty, external pressure does not arrive at the edge and stay there. It interacts with internal politics. Armies needed for defense are also political constituencies. Generals needed for survival are also potential rivals. Regions whose resources the whole empire needs are also tempted to think first about their own protection. That is what makes the 3rd century crisis an important starting point. It concentrates core vulnerabilities and shows how internal weakness and external threats reinforce each other. It also teaches a second lesson. Survival after crisis is not the same thing as full return to earlier stability. The empire survives, but survival requires reorganization. That is where Diocletian enters the story. In the late 3rd century, Diocletian responds with sweeping reforms meant to stabilize rule, improve defense, and solve problems of scale. A vast empire with multiple frontiers and frequent succession crises is difficult for one court and one ruler to manage effectively. Diocletian's answer includes multiple rulers, more provinces, sharper administrative divisions, fiscal reform, and efforts to regularize succession and defense. The most famous element is the Tetrarchy, a system designed around four rulers. The logic is straightforward. If threats arise in several regions at once, more than one imperial center can respond. If succession is anticipated, accession might become less improvisational and less violent. If administration is subdivided, the state may govern more closely and collect more reliably. If fiscal systems are strengthened, the military can be supplied more consistently. Yet the Tetrarchy also reveals a recurring truth about institutional reform. Solutions to one problem can generate new problems elsewhere. Multiple rulers reduce the burden on any one person, but they introduce coordination challenges. More courts can mean more opportunities for ambition and more zones of loyalty. More administrative layers can improve oversight, but they can also increase complexity, enforcement burdens, and dependence on officials whose incentives do not always match those of the center. A planned succession system can reduce uncertainty on paper. But if rival claimants and armies do not accept the arrangement, conflict can return. That is why civil war does not permanently end with the Tetrarchy. It is a serious and intelligent attempt to stabilize the empire, but it cannot eliminate the underlying issue. Supreme power in Rome remains immensely valuable and is not always peacefully transferable. After Diocletian, the 4th century is shaped by reconfiguration under and after Constantine. The empire does not revert to some earlier simplicity. Instead, it develops a more durable, late imperial form. Constantine emerges from the conflicts that follow the Tetrarchic experiment and reasserts stronger central authority, while much of the enlarged administrative and military machinery remains. This matters because the 4th century is not a simple rebound from chaos. It is a new settlement. That settlement carries both strengths and vulnerabilities. The state becomes more structured and, in some respects, more resilient than during the worst years of the 3rd century crisis. At the same time, it becomes more complex, more expensive to coordinate, and still exposed to contested succession and the political significance of regional command. The army remains crucial. Regional command stays politically significant. Fiscal demands remain high because security remains expensive. Local elites remain indispensable because the center still depends on provincial cooperation for revenue, order, and implementation. In other words, the 4th century shows that reform can stabilize without fully simplifying. It can buy time, restore capacity, and create impressive endurance, yet still preserve feedback loops that later become dangerous. The key comparative point follows from this. Institutional survival after major stress does not always mean the stress mechanisms disappear. Sometimes they are contained, sometimes they are displaced, sometimes they are built into a new equilibrium that works until fresh shocks expose its limits. By the 5th century, the Western Empire undergoes the political transformation most people loosely call the fall of Rome. Even here, the process does not fit a single cause story. What changes most in the West is the ability to maintain coherent authority across regions. the ability to command military force directly and reliably weakens. The ability to collect and distribute resources at the required scale becomes harder. Lasting loyalty from key elites and armed actors becomes more difficult to secure. Recruitment becomes difficult in some contexts, while fiscal pressure stays intense. Regionalized command becomes more important. Administrative complexity makes coordination harder when trust falls. Elite incentives do not always align with imperial cohesion. Civic burdens become more unevenly shared. Negotiated settlement with outside groups becomes more central. Foederati can fight for the empire, defend regions, or support rulers. Yet their growing prominence also shows how the imperial center increasingly manages security through bargaining, accommodation, and delegated force, rather than through a fully unified and uncontested monopoly of arms. The deeper problem is not simply that people cross a frontier. The deeper problem is that internal weakness and external pressure reinforce each other. A state with strong legitimacy, stable succession, dependable revenue, and cohesive command can often absorb migration and military threat more effectively. A state already divided and fiscally strained experiences the same pressures very differently. Modern scholarship therefore generally rejects monocausal explanations for the West's transformation. Historians typically do not find it persuasive to blame everything on outside invasions alone, or on Christian conversion alone, or on moral decay alone, or on simple resource depletion alone. Those explanations isolate one visible factor and treat it as the whole mechanism. A more useful approach asks how several mechanisms interact. Some scholars emphasize fiscal breakdown. Others emphasize military effectiveness and the state's shrinking ability to recruit, command, and provision force. Others prioritize legitimacy, political violence, and the corrosive effect of repeated internal conflict. Still others stress how climate shifts, disease burdens, and migration pressure can intensify existing weaknesses. These are not always competing explanations in a strict sense. Often they locate the heaviest pressure point within a shared multi-causal system. A crisis of legitimacy can trigger usurpation. Usurpation can trigger civil war. Civil war can reduce fiscal collection and destroy trust. Fiscal weakness can lower military effectiveness. Military weakness can push the center toward harsher bargains with regional commanders or outside groups. Those bargains can deepen fragmentation, which can then further weaken legitimacy. This produces a feedback loop. One strain worsens another, and the worsening circles back into the first. In institutional history, feedback loops matter because they turn a sequence of problems into a pathway. Because the subject is complex, the evidence must be handled carefully. Historians do not possess a single archive that tells the whole story. They triangulate across different types of sources, each with strengths and limits. Coins and currency patterns can show monetary stress and fiscal behavior, but they do not directly reveal motives. Laws and administrative records reveal what the state tries to regulate and what rulers prioritize. But preserved law does not automatically mean effective enforcement. Inscriptions preserve public language about authority, but they often reflect ideals and ceremonial politics as much as reality. Narrative histories preserve events and perceptions, but they are selective and biased. Archaeology and scientific reconstructions add material context, but material change still requires interpretation. When these lines of evidence point in the same direction, confidence grows. When they diverge, caution is warranted. That caution is not weakness. It is part of responsible historical method. And it becomes especially important when Rome is used for modern comparison. famous cases are easy to overextend. The comparison must remain disciplined. Rome can illuminate general mechanisms, especially questions about how declining trust raises enforcement costs, how polarization damages coordination, how fiscal burdens interact with military commitments, and how elite incentives can diverge from system stability. The analogy becomes misleading when it assumes that a modern democratic republic with constitutional rights and nuclear deterrence will reenact an ancient imperial script. Those differences are not cosmetic. They change the speed of crises, the tools of response, the scale of administration, the basis of legitimacy, and the consequences of violence. With that discipline in mind, we can now state the main Roman stress pathways clearly. Succession instability turns political competition into repeated uncertainty and sometimes violence. Fiscal pressure makes military security more expensive and social compliance harder to sustain. Recruitment difficulty forces the state to work harder to fill its ranks or to bargain more creatively for armed support. Regionalized command gives local armies and commanders interests that may not fully align with the center. Administrative complexity increases coordination burdens and creates more points of friction between policy and practice. Elite evasion weakens burden sharing when privileged groups protect themselves, shift costs elsewhere, or tie their fate more closely to local advantage than to imperial cohesion. Civic weakening reduces the willingness of communities to trust institutions, bear sacrifice, and participate in common obligations. Negotiated settlement with outside groups can solve immediate security problems while redistributing force and authority in ways the center cannot fully control. On the American side, the later comparison focuses on legitimacy, rule of law, polarization, administrative capacity, inequality, fiscal sustainability, military commitments, civic trust, media fragmentation, and elite incentives. The point is not that each modern factor has a direct Roman twin. The point is that large societies survive by maintaining enough trust, capacity, obedience, and coordination to solve shared problems without constant breakdown. Legitimacy matters because a government seen as unfair or ineffective must spend more to enforce what it once could ask. Rule of law matters because selective enforcement corrodes trust. Polarization matters because rival camps may stop treating institutions as common property. Administrative capacity matters because policy failure can destroy credibility even when intentions are good. Inequality matters because unequal burdens weaken solidarity. Fiscal sustainability matters because states cannot promise indefinitely without paying eventually. Military commitments matter because force projection consumes attention, resources, and political capital. Civic trust matters because low trust raises transaction costs across the system. Media fragmentation matters because shared reality becomes harder to sustain. Elite incentives matter because institutional resilience depends heavily on whether influential actors gain more from preserving rules than from exploiting them. Rome is most useful here not as a mirror, but as a model of interacting institutional stress. It suggests that decline, when it occurs, is often conditional rather than fated. It emerges when several problems reinforce one another, and when attempted fixes solve one issue while worsening another. It also shows that adaptation can succeed for long stretches. Rome does not move from strength to disappearance in a straight line. It reforms, recenters, reorganizes, bargains, survives, and changes. This is the groundwork for what comes next. The late Roman fall should now appear not as a single event, but as a time-extended multi-causal transformation. Late antiquity should function as a frame for thinking about change, rather than just endings. The key terms are ready to use. Imperial legitimacy, as perceived right to rule and demand sacrifice. Civil-military relations as the balance between political authority and armed force. The fiscal-military state as the linkage between revenue and administration to security. Administrative fragmentation as the shift toward regions and rival chains of authority. And foederati as the growing role of treaty-bound groups in military and political life. The next step treats the late Roman problem as a mechanism map, rather than as a list of separate causes. The empire does not weaken because one thing goes wrong in isolation. It weakens because several strains begin to reinforce one another. Political instability raises military costs. Military costs intensify fiscal extraction. Fiscal extraction encourages evasion, resentment, and flight. That weakens revenue and local cooperation. Weaker revenue and cooperation then reduce military effectiveness and administrative reach. External raids or migrations become harder to contain, which creates fresh insecurity, and the cycle continues. One Roman feedback loop can be stated simply. Raids worsen, taxes increase, flight from burdens accelerates, military capacity weakens, and then raids worsen again. Once the process is seen in that circular form, the story looks less like a mystery with one missing cause, and more like a system whose parts begin to damage one another. A good place to start is succession, because weak succession rules turn ordinary politics into a repeated test of force. In a stable system, elites may compete fiercely, but they usually know the accepted procedure for transferring supreme power. In Rome, that question is never fully settled. Bloodline, adoption, military support, court influence, and success in conflict can all matter, and none gives a permanent answer. When legal rules are weak or contested, every emperor's illness, death, or loss of prestige creates opportunity. Commanders calculate. Court factions hedge. Provincial elites delay commitment until they see where the army will lean. In that environment, usurpation is not an accident. It is an incentive built into the system. A general with troops and ambition can always imagine that his bid might succeed, especially if the reigning emperor appears weak, distant, or politically isolated. The result is civil war, or at least the constant threat of it. That has consequences far beyond the immediate contest for the throne. Civil war damages state capacity in several ways at once. Armies that should defend frontiers are redirected against fellow Romans. A soldier marching against a rival claimant is a soldier not guarding a river line, escorting supplies, or deterring raids. Civil war also consumes revenue. Campaigning requires pay, transport, food, animals, equipment, replacement recruits, and political rewards for supporters. It disrupts administration. Officials do not know which orders will survive. Tax collection becomes uncertain when local authorities are unsure who will rule next month. And repeated internal conflict teaches a corrosive lesson to elites across the empire. Loyalty becomes conditional. It is not always prudent to commit early or fully to the center. That lesson may be rational for individuals, but collectively it weakens the state. A government that must constantly ask whether its own supporters are fully committed is already paying a hidden cost of political instability. As this point becomes central, the comparison with the United States becomes meaningful, but only if we keep it bounded. The United States does not face succession by provincial armies, and that difference is fundamental. There are no frontier legions proclaiming presidents. The structural parallel lies elsewhere, in confidence about election legitimacy, peaceful transfer of power, and trust in constitutional procedures. A modern republic depends on rules that tell losers to stand down, because the process is accepted as binding. Once that acceptance fails, the system enters a legitimacy contest. It is not Roman succession politics in form, it is an analogy in mechanism. The key question becomes whether political competition remains bounded by rules, or whether rival camps begin to assume that only victory is legitimate. Once that belief spreads, enforcement costs rise. Trust in law weakens. Ordinary governance becomes more fragile. Late imperial administrative redesign is best understood as an attempt to stabilize a massive empire that has become too large, too threatened, and too politically volatile for older forms of rule. The response is broad but coherent. More rulers share imperial authority. Provinces become smaller. Offices are more sharply defined. Chains of responsibility are made clearer on paper. Civil and military authority are increasingly separated. The logic is easy to grasp. A huge empire facing simultaneous threats needs more than one center of attention. Smaller units are easier to supervise than giant ones. More explicit offices may reduce confusion. Separate civilian and military power can prevent one official from controlling both tax machinery and armed force in the same region, which can reduce the risk of coups. These reforms are not signs of irrational decline. They are serious efforts to govern scale and danger more effectively. At the same time, redesign can create new fragility. Every added layer is another place where information must be passed upward and orders must be translated downward. More offices may improve specialization, but they can also mean slower decisions, more paperwork, and more chances for blame to shift from one office to another. Smaller provinces improve oversight in theory, yet they multiply coordination problems across regions. More rulers can cover more territory, but they also create more courts, more entourages, more rival interests, and more possible centers of loyalty. Clearer chains of command on paper do not guarantee clarity in practice, when personalities, local pressures, and military emergencies intervene. Administrative complexity is therefore double-edged. It can increase capacity when trust is high and cooperation is strong. It can become rigid and brittle when trust falls and speed matters. The separation of civil and military authority shows this trade-off especially well. If a governor commands taxes, courts, and troops all at once, he becomes a potential usurper. Dividing those powers reduces that risk. Yet division also means that in a crisis, the people who need to act together may answer to different superiors, follow different priorities, and move at different speeds. The state becomes safer from concentrated provincial power, but sometimes less agile in fast emergencies. Modern governance can face its own coordination traps. Executive and legislative branches can deadlock. Federal and state authorities can clash over responsibility. Policies can reverse from one administration to the next, making long-horizon planning difficult. Agencies may divide authority so finely that urgent decisions stall. In such conditions, even a wealthy and technologically advanced state can look oddly weak in practice because capacity is not only a matter of resources, it is also a matter of sustained coordination. Rome's problem is not identical to modern gridlock, but the comparison is instructive because both show how a state can lose effectiveness when decision-making becomes fragmented, discontinuous, or mistrusted. The army of late antiquity also needs careful description. It is not simply a degraded copy of the old legionary ideal. It is a changed system responding to a changed strategic world. Multiple frontiers, repeated civil wars, different enemy patterns, greater need for mobility, and more intense bargaining with armed groups all shape its form. This distinction matters because Moralizing language about decline can hide real adaptation. The late Roman army is not merely worse. It is reorganized for different conditions, and some changes are sensible. Yet adaptation does not remove strain. Recruitment becomes harder as the available pool narrows or becomes less willing. Service may offer lower incentives when pay is uncertain, burdens are heavy, and local attachments compete with imperial demands. The state leans more heavily on conscription when voluntary enlistment is insufficient. Training becomes uneven because time, money, and stable institutional attention are not distributed evenly across the system. Discipline problems appear, but those problems are better understood as symptoms of strain than as a simple collapse of character. Reliance on non-traditional manpower grows out of the same pressures. If the empire cannot fill ranks through older channels, it looks elsewhere. That can mean recruiting more heavily from populations not fully integrated into traditional Roman military culture, or bargaining with armed groups whose service is secured through treaties, subsidies, land, or recognition, rather than through complete absorption into a uniform command structure. In the short term, this is practical. States use the manpower they can get. Over time, it changes the balance of power. Armed groups inside imperial territory gain bargaining leverage precisely because the state needs them. Force becomes less purely monopolized and more negotiated. The Gothic entry in the later 3rd centuries and the Battle of Adrianople show how migration, administrative failure, military defeat, and long-term bargaining can become linked. When large Gothic groups seek entry into imperial territory, the issue is not only whether outsiders are present at the frontier. The deeper test is whether the state can register, provision, supervise, relocate, and when necessary, control large armed populations entering under pressure. When that administrative task fails, the problem changes shape. Corruption, mismanagement, or simple incapacity can turn managed entry into revolt. A Roman emperor's death in battle demonstrates how an administrative breakdown can become a strategic disaster. After that kind of failure, the empire increasingly has to bargain with large armed groups inside imperial space rather than simply excluding them or absorbing them on its own terms. Frontier pressure can become internal political restructuring. The Rhine crossing of 406 to 407 illustrates how hard it becomes to separate external pressure and internal transformation during Western political weakness. As multiple groups move across that frontier, frontier defense, internal civil conflict, and settlement bargaining become interwoven. It is no longer clear where external pressure ends and internal transformation begins. If troops are diverted by usurpation, the frontier becomes thinner. If the frontier weakens, armed groups move inland. Once inland, they become matters not only of defense, but of negotiation, local survival, and regional political realignment. Provincial elites may cut bargains to protect themselves. Commanders may use these pressures in struggles for power. The process is cumulative. By the time Rome is sacked in 410, the event is symbolically enormous because it makes Western weakness visible at the empire's old center. Yet it does not end the empire by itself. Roman rule continues in important forms, especially in the East. Even in the West, political authority does not vanish in a single day. The deposition of Romulus Augustulus in 476 is therefore best treated as a conventional political boundary. It marks the end of a Western imperial office, not the sudden disappearance of Roman society, law, religion, or memory. A useful modern parallel here is not ancient migration warfare itself, since that element transfers poorly. What transfers is strategic overstretch and the political consequences of commitments that strain readiness. A modern great power can face high deployment tempo, readiness concerns, industrial bottlenecks, alliance obligations, and public frustration when commitments appear costly or inconclusive. Failed or weakened commitments can damage credibility abroad and trust at home. Even so, the analogy must be tightly limited. Rome lacks modern logistics, industrial production at scale, advanced surveillance, cyber systems, nuclear deterrence, and the United States Global Alliance Network. Those differences are enormous. They change the speed of war, the scale of mobilization, the visibility of threats, and the meaning of deterrence itself. So no Roman frontier event predicts a modern American security crisis in direct form. What does transfer is the warning that military commitments, political division, and administrative weakness can interact in ways that make each problem harder to solve. At the center of all of this sits fiscal military logic. A sovereign state must pay, feed, equip, move, and maintain its forces. If it cannot do those things reliably, sovereignty becomes more conditional and more dependent on bargaining. Late Roman fiscal strain matters not because money is abstractly important, but because military readiness rests on it. Currency debasement and inflationary pressure belong inside that story. When a state tries to meet obligations with monetary instruments that people trust less over time, the problem is not only a technical change in coin. Trust in payment weakens. Prices become harder to stabilize. Accounting becomes more difficult. Supplying armies through purchase becomes less predictable. The state may still issue coin, but coin alone no longer solves provisioning. Taxation in kind then becomes more important. Grain, animals, textiles, and transport services are taken directly because they are more reliable for sustaining the military machine. That response is practical, but it also signals that the state can no longer depend on coinage alone for secure provisioning. Fiscal pressure also reveals how formal power can grow on paper, while effective capacity shrinks in practice. Tax demands may rise, yet the real revenue base can narrow. This happens when burdens are distributed regressively, when elite groups evade or shift obligations, when local collection becomes punitive and inefficient, and when people flee land, status, or registration to escape liability. The state may demand more precisely because it is getting less, but higher pressure can worsen the underlying problem. Wealthy and well-connected actors often have better tools for delay, exemption, or avoidance. Smaller producers and local office holders feel the squeeze more directly. Municipal elites who once served as intermediaries between center and locality can find themselves trapped, responsible for delivering revenues that their communities increasingly resist or cannot provide. In this way, fiscal stress becomes administrative stress and then social stress. A tax system does not merely gather resources. It tests whether a society still believes burdens are shared in a tolerable and legitimate way. That mechanism travels well, in a limited sense, to the modern United States. The forms are different. The United States does not provision armies through grain levies in the Roman manner, and it operates within modern finance, modern credit, modern institutions, and a vastly larger productive economy. Yet the structural issue remains recognizable. A state can appear wealthy, while public capacity feels thin if burdens are perceived as uneven, if wealth is highly concentrated, if labor insecurity grows, and if regions experience very different levels of resilience. Economic inequality then becomes more than a social fact. It affects whether people trust the fairness of institutions, whether they accept public obligations, and whether they support long-term investments that do not deliver immediate private gain. If citizens conclude that some groups capture benefits while others carry costs, voluntary compliance declines, and enforcement becomes more expensive. That is one way fiscal stress and social distrust begin to feed each other. Administrative overextension deepens the problem. More provinces, more offices, and separate military and civil chains of command can help reach deeper into local life. At the same time, they create more points where orders can stall, be diluted, or be resisted. Complexity is not the same as capacity. Sometimes complexity is capacity. Sometimes it is accumulated friction. A late Roman order that looks highly articulated can still struggle to act flexibly because too many parts must coordinate at once. Modern states face a related danger when legal, bureaucratic, and political veto points multiply faster than common purpose. In the United States, long-horizon projects can become difficult to sustain when elections, media cycles, partisan incentives, budget fights, and intergovernmental conflict reward short-term gains over continuity. Rome's offices and the United States constitutional structures are not the same thing. Roman patronage and court competition are not identical to modern elections, bureaucracies, courts, parties, or rights frameworks. Even so, both settings show how institutions can underperform when accountability is blurred and no actor can or will carry a project across time. Environmental and biological pressures also belong in the picture as compounding factors. They are rarely sufficient on their own to explain imperial transformation, but they can reduce resilience across several systems at once. Climate variability can weaken agricultural reliability in vulnerable regions. Poor harvests can lower tax capacity, reduce food security, and intensify migration or unrest. Disease can cut labor supply, shrink recruitment pools, and damage confidence in normal routines of life and authority. Population pressure can sharpen competition over land, food, and protection. The plague of Cyprian offers an example from an already unstable period. Epidemic disease can thin farms, workshops, transport networks, and military manpower simultaneously. It also changes psychology. When mortality rises and the future becomes harder to predict, social confidence weakens. People do not only lose labor, they lose trust in the ordinary continuity of the world. Historians debate exact scale and regional variation, and they should. But the broad mechanism is clear enough. Epidemic disease can strike a polity already struggling with military, fiscal, and political instability, and it can make each of those problems more difficult to solve. Social cohesion, therefore, matters as much as coin, troops, and offices. No large state survives on coercion alone. It needs legitimacy in the sense already defined, but it also needs a lived belief that sacrifice is shared and that institutions are worth supporting even when burdens are real. When common civic purpose erodes, the costs of governing increase. Elites become more localist. Communities think first about immediate protection. Shared obligations look less like a common project and more like extraction for someone else's benefit. That wider view helps explain why external pressure can become transformation rather than mere intrusion. Once frontier breaches lead to inland settlement, treaty negotiation, and local political reorientation, outsiders are no longer just pressing on the edges. They are woven into the empire's internal bargaining order. Local actors may decide that accommodation with nearby armed groups is safer than obedience to a distant center. At that point, the issue is not simply invasion. It is the redirection of loyalty and the partial relocation of sovereignty. This also explains why scholars continue to weight causes differently. Some emphasize fiscal breakdown, others stress military effectiveness and the state's shrinking ability to recruit, command, and supply force. Others focus on administrative weakness, social cohesion, or the corrosive effects of repeated internal conflict. Environmental historians and disease scholars highlight climate stress, epidemic shocks, and demographic disruption. Others emphasize migration pressure and the transformation of frontier management into internal settlement politics. These are not always mutually exclusive schools. Often they are arguments about which mechanism does the most work inside a shared crisis system. The strongest overall picture remains multicausal. Internal weakness and external pressure matter most when they amplify one another. The Rome to America comparison therefore works best at the level of structure. It is strongest when it asks about governance stress, legitimacy erosion, fiscal pressure, social distrust, and elite incentive misalignment. It is weakest when it assumes identical institutions or identical outcomes. The United States' closest analog to Roman succession instability is not imperial usurpation, but anxiety about election legitimacy, peaceful transfer of power, rule of law stability, and trust in constitutional procedures. Its closest analog to late Roman coordination problems is not a tetrarchic court, but recurring gridlock, federal-state conflict, policy reversal, and the difficulty of maintaining credible administrative projects across decades. Its closest analog to Roman civic weakening is not the decay of ancient city religion or patronage in their original form, but polarization and distrust that reduce voluntary compliance, increase enforcement costs, weaken compromise, and make ordinary governance more expensive. When people do not trust one another or the institutions above them, the cheap form of governance disappears. The expensive form remains, where every decision requires litigation, coercion, constant monitoring, or permanent political mobilization. Elite behavior belongs inside this modern comparison as well. Late Rome includes patrons, office seekers, court factions, and regional strongmen. Modern America operates through elections, parties, donors, media systems, bureaucratic careers, courts, and interest networks. These are not equivalent structures, and it would be a mistake to flatten them into one another. Still, a central question remains the same. Do influential actors gain more from preserving common rules than from exploiting them? If incentives shift toward exploitation, institutions can remain formally intact while becoming functionally weaker. Media incentives can reward outrage rather than compromise. Career incentives can favor short-term visibility over long-term stewardship. Financial incentives can reward extraction over maintenance. In that environment, long-term planning becomes especially difficult. Rome repeatedly shows what happens when rulers cannot carry policy reliably across succession struggles and regional bargaining. The modern version asks whether a constitutional system can maintain credible projects across election cycles, budget shocks, media pressure, and polarized publics. Limits must be repeated because they are part of the method, not an afterthought. Technology changes the comparison. Demography changes it. Legal rights change it. State capacity changes it. Ideology, constitutional structure, immigration regimes, global trade, global finance, and modern deterrence all change the comparison. A modern industrial and digital state can monitor, move, produce, borrow, and communicate on scales Rome cannot approach. Nuclear weapons alter the meaning of major war. Global finance alters the meaning of fiscal strain. Mass literacy, democratic legitimacy, and constitutional rights alter how authority is contested. Because of those differences, Rome is not a script for American decline. It is a warning model about how institutions behave when legitimacy weakens, burdens feel unfair, coordination fails, and feedback loops go untreated. As this part closes, the most transferable dimensions are therefore not the spectacular ones. They are legitimacy, fiscal military capacity, elite incentives, social trust, and feedback loops. These are durable analytical tools. They help explain why systems under pressure can survive for long periods. They also help explain why reforms can strengthen and complicate governance, and why decline is often cumulative rather than sudden. The least transferable dimensions are those tied most tightly to Rome's specific world: ancient migration warfare, pre-modern communications, Roman succession politics in their original form, non-democratic imperial legitimacy, and the absence of modern technology and deterrence. Keeping both sides of that distinction in view keeps the comparison disciplined and prevents it from becoming sensational. The question that remains is whether modern institutions can interrupt dangerous feedback loops before adaptation hardens into decline. Decline, in this final analysis, is conditional. It is not a destiny written into the age of a state, the size of a population, or the memory of past greatness. Rome gives a powerful model because it shows how large systems can weaken when several forms of strain reinforce one another. But Rome is not a literal prediction for the United States, and it is not a simple script waiting to be performed again. The more disciplined claim is narrower and, in a way, more useful. When legitimacy weakens, fiscal room narrows. When fiscal room narrows, military commitments strain capacity. When commitments strain capacity, administration loses coordination and effectiveness. When administration loses effectiveness, elites have more room to pursue advantage over stewardship. When elites pursue advantage, social trust declines. Under these conditions, a state can enter feedback loops that are difficult to stop. Difficult is not the same as inevitable. A feedback loop can deepen, and it can also be interrupted. That distinction matters because the history of Rome is often remembered as a fall, while the actual process was slower and uneven. The end of the Western Imperial Office in 476 is conventionally treated as a political boundary. Yet it is not a sudden disappearance of Roman life. Institutions, laws, habits, cities, churches, languages, elites, and memories continue in altered form. Some places change violently. Others are reorganized gradually, with households, offices, capital, and confidence shifting bit by bit. Decline can look less like a single crash than like cumulative disinvestment and the slow normalization of lower capacity. The forecasting framework that follows is therefore not a prophecy. It is a way of tracking pathways and early warning signals. A warning model is useful because it identifies how small institutional misalignments can compound over decades. It also helps trace how distrust can lower compliance, how lower compliance can raise enforcement costs, and how higher enforcement costs can reduce resources available for maintenance. Poor maintenance then deepens public frustration, and frustration can produce still more distrust. The danger is not any one link taken alone. The danger lies in interaction. The first pathway is institutional distrust and delegitimization. A government does not need universal admiration to function. What it needs is enough basic acceptance that rules are followed most of the time, losses are tolerated, taxes are paid, court judgments are treated as binding, and public offices are seen as responsibilities rather than prizes for factional capture. When that acceptance erodes, the cost of governing rises. People comply less readily. Officials must spend more time monitoring, litigating, punishing, persuading, and defending ordinary decisions. Laws and public programs that once worked through routine trust begin to require constant enforcement. They are judged not only by results, but by suspicion about who benefits and who is being targeted. Delegitimization also weakens compromise. If rival political groups believe institutions are basically fair, they may fight inside them and still accept temporary defeat. If they believe institutions are fundamentally captured or illegitimate, compromise begins to look like surrender. Concessions become suspect. Technical administration becomes politicized. Routine decisions are interpreted as partisan war by other means. The state can still have agencies, courts, budgets, and laws. Yet governance capacity declines when social preconditions for using those instruments weaken. In Rome, this appears in imperial legitimacy, succession conflict, elite hedging, and regional bargaining. In modern form, the mechanism remains recognizable. A constitutional democracy depends on losers accepting procedures, winners accepting limits, officials applying rules predictably, and citizens believing that public authority has a claim beyond factional convenience. The early warning signs in this pathway are not only spectacular acts of crisis. They include slower changes in expectations. Citizens begin to assume that rules are selectively enforced. Political actors describe every defeat as illegitimate. Public offices are treated as tools for punishing enemies rather than as responsibilities held in trust. Administrative expertise is dismissed when inconvenient, but invoked when useful. Courts, elections, and agencies become less trusted not because they fail in one dramatic instance, but because repeated accusations, real errors, perceived unfairness, and strategic attacks accumulate. Once enough actors behave as if the system is only a battlefield, their behavior makes that belief more plausible. The second pathway is political paralysis and the loss of credible maintenance. Large states do not survive only by responding to emergencies. They survive by maintaining the ordinary systems that make emergencies less destructive. Roads, ports, electrical grids, water systems, public health capacity, procurement systems, data infrastructure, courts, schools, emergency management, defense supply chains, and administrative routines all require renewal before breakdown becomes visible. Maintenance is politically difficult because its benefits are often invisible. A bridge that does not collapse produces no dramatic victory. A disease surveillance system that catches a threat early may be noticed less than a failure that turns into a crisis. Administrative modernization may save years of frustration, yet it rarely creates the symbolic drama that political competition rewards. Gridlock damages maintenance because it interrupts continuity. Infrastructure renewal is postponed when parties cannot agree on funding, permitting, allocation, or credit. Administrative modernization stalls when no faction wants to strengthen an apparatus it expects to control later. Fiscal planning can become theatrical rather than credible, with repeated short-term fixes replacing stable commitments. Public health preparedness can be underfunded after a crisis fades from memory. Defense procurement can be pulled between strategic needs, local interests, budget limits, and shifting political signals. Routine state competence weakens when institutions that convert resources into durable capacity cannot sustain agreement across time. The Roman comparison stays useful at the level of structure here. Late Roman administrative reform aims to stabilize rule across scale, succession, and defense, but it also creates complexity and coordination burdens. The United States has radically different institutions, including elections, courts, professional bureaucracies, federalism, public debt markets, and a technologically advanced economy. Yet it can face a related problem. It can have enormous resources while struggling to carry long-term projects through shifting political cycles, overlapping jurisdictions, legal disputes, and polarized media environments. Capacity is not merely wealth. Capacity is the ability to decide, implement, maintain, correct, and continue. The third pathway is fiscal stress. Fiscal stress does not mean a state simply runs out of money like a household might. Modern public finance is far more complex. It means that commitments, revenue, borrowing costs, economic growth, and political legitimacy begin to pull against one another. Several routes can lead there. Growth may slow, making existing promises harder to finance. Interest burdens may rise, so more revenue services past borrowing rather than building future capacity. Spending may become inefficient because fragmented politics protects weak spending while blocking higher return investment. The tax base may become less elastic, meaning revenue does not grow smoothly with social needs. Regional inequality may widen, so some places generate and attract investment, while others require more support but receive less opportunity. Public commitments can outrun the revenue system meant to sustain them. Fiscal stress becomes especially dangerous when it collides with strategic demands. Under budget pressure, a state may defer maintenance because deferred maintenance is easier to hide than immediate cuts. It may underinvest in personnel, training, public administration, and procurement capacity because those investments are less visible than crisis spending. It may weaken supply chains by tolerating excessive dependence on fragile sources, thin inventories, or aging industrial capacity. It may struggle to respond to simultaneous crises because each emergency consumes fiscal and administrative room needed for the next one. In that setting, even a wealthy state can become brittle. It can have money in the abstract while lacking the right capacity in the right place at the right time. Rome's fiscal-military logic clarifies a general principle. In the late empire, revenue, taxation, logistics, military pay, and political legitimacy are tightly connected. If tax burdens feel unfair, compliance weakens. If compliance weakens, coercion rises. If coercion rises, legitimacy suffers. If revenue falters, military effectiveness declines. If military effectiveness declines, insecurity grows, which then makes revenue collection harder. The United States does not have Rome's tax system, coinage structure, agricultural base, or military organization. Yet the general lesson remains. Fiscal capacity is not only accounting. It measures whether a society can mobilize resources for common purposes without destroying trust in the process. The fourth pathway is inequality and cohesion. Inequality matters not as a moral slogan, but as an institutional variable. Widening gaps in wealth, security, opportunity, health, education, and regional prospects can reduce shared purpose. If citizens inhabit increasingly different social worlds, they may stop seeing public systems as common property. Some groups experience public institutions mainly as protection or investment. Others experience them mainly as surveillance, extraction, neglect, or failure. Some regions feel they subsidize others. Some communities feel abandoned by national growth. Some households can buy private substitutes for public goods. Others depend on public systems that are weakening. Over time, risk sharing becomes harder. Risk sharing is central to state resilience. Societies must decide how to distribute the costs of defense, infrastructure, aging systems, disaster response, education, healthcare, economic transition, and disruption. When cohesion is strong, groups may accept burdens because they believe other Caesars are contributing and because they expect future reciprocity. When cohesion is weak, burdens are interpreted as losses imposed by hostile outsiders. Bargaining becomes more zero-sum. Public investment becomes easier to block. Emergency aid becomes politicized. Long-term planning is undermined by suspicion that shared projects are really transfers to the undeserving. Inequality also changes elite incentives. When powerful actors can protect themselves from institutional decline, their commitment to repair may weaken. Institutional capture becomes more attractive if public rules can be reshaped for private advantage. Tax avoidance becomes more rewarding if legitimacy no longer restrains aggressive strategies. Regulatory arbitrage becomes more tempting when firms, investors, and wealthy individuals can shift across jurisdictions while ordinary people remain exposed. Private exit becomes more feasible when elites can buy security, education, healthcare, information, and mobility outside common systems. The danger is not only that elites become rich. The danger is that influential actors may gain more from exploiting institutional weakness than from rebuilding shared capacity. Rome offers a structural warning here. Late Roman elites are not modern corporate actors, donors, investors, or media owners. They operate in a different world, yet the test is familiar. Do influential groups tie their fate to the resilience of the whole system, or do they preserve private advantage while public capacity erodes? When local magnates, office holders, commanders, or privileged groups shift burdens away from themselves, the fiscal and social base of the state narrows. Modern institutions differ profoundly, but the test remains. A system tends to stay healthier when those with the greatest capacity find it in their interest to support rule of law, fair contribution, institutional maintenance, and broad opportunity. It tends to weaken when exit and capture look more rational than stewardship. The fifth pathway is social fragmentation and cost sharing. Fragmentation is not the same as disagreement. Democratic societies need disagreement. They need parties, argument, criticism, and organized conflict. Fragmentation becomes dangerous when disagreement loses a shared institutional frame. If groups no longer trust common facts, common procedures, or common obligations, collective action becomes difficult even when problems are widely recognized. People may agree that infrastructure is aging, that health systems need resilience, that defense supply chains require attention, and that fiscal planning must improve. They can still fail to act because they disagree about who should pay, who should control the process, and who can be trusted with the result. A reduced willingness to share burdens changes bargaining. Each region, class, party, industry, or identity group seeks insulation from costs. Regional divergence increases when prosperous areas attract more investment, while struggling areas lose people, revenue, institutions, or hope. Collective action fragments when local survival strategies make national coordination harder. In Rome, regionalization becomes part of the story as commanders, local elites, armed groups, and provinces respond to immediate insecurity in ways that do not always preserve imperial cohesion. The United States is not an empire of provinces, but the risk of divergence is real. If regions experience the state differently, trust national institutions differently, and develop incompatible expectations about obligation, the capacity for common action declines. The sixth pathway is military and security breakdown risk. For Rome, military effectiveness is tied to recruitment, logistics, command cohesion, frontier pressure, civil conflict, and negotiation with armed groups. For the United States, the structure is different. It has advanced technology, global alliances, nuclear deterrence, professional forces, intelligence systems, industrial logistics, and worldwide commitments. These differences change what security stress looks like. Even so, security strain can still become a feedback loop. Strategic overstretch raises costs and exposes readiness gaps. Readiness degradation weakens deterrence. Weakened deterrence invites more pressure. More pressure can require more deployments, emergency spending, and political justification. Repeated failure or stalemate, or visible unpreparedness, can damage public trust and alliance credibility at the same time. Defense industrial constraints matter here because security depends not only on platforms, but also on production, maintenance depth, software, skilled labor, scarce inputs, logistics, and procurement systems that can scale under stress. A state can have large budgets while struggling to produce enough of what it needs quickly. It can have advanced platforms while lacking sufficient maintenance capacity. It can have alliance commitments that depend on political continuity at home. Security risks then feed back into political legitimacy. Domestic political consequences can be severe. Citizens may lose confidence in leaders. Allies may doubt commitments. Rivals may test boundaries. Political factions may use failure to delegitimize one another rather than repair the underlying system. This is one reason prevention must be systems level. It is not enough to spend more on any single dimension if trust, competence, and fiscal sustainability are weakening elsewhere. These pathways can combine into a conditional decline scenario. In such a scenario, institutional distrust deepens over time. Election legitimacy, court legitimacy, administrative neutrality, and law enforcement credibility become recurring battlefields. Policy continuity weakens as each governing coalition reverses or obstructs the last. Fiscal room narrows because commitments grow, interest burdens rise, growth disappoints, and the tax system fails to sustain public expectations. Public systems deteriorate unevenly by region, so some communities experience competent administration and opportunity, while others experience visible decay. Political actors increasingly pursue short-term advantage because the rewards for restraint decline. Under these conditions, citizens may begin to expect less from government, comply less willingly, and retreat into private or regional forms of protection. That retreat then weakens the public systems whose failures justified it. Decline would not have to look like a single dramatic collapse. It could unfold through normalized dysfunction. Budget fights become routine. Administrative vacancies persist. Courts and election systems face continuous suspicion. Infrastructure ages faster than it is renewed. Emergency response works well in some places and poorly in others. Public health capacity expands during crises and contracts afterward. Defense procurement remains expensive but slow. Local governments vary sharply in competence. Citizens with resources buy substitutes, while citizens without resources absorb failure. The nation can remain wealthy and innovative and culturally influential, yet still experience a widening gap between formal power and practical capacity. A second scenario is also possible, and it is equally important. In that scenario, correction begins before negative feedback loops become self-reinforcing. Institutional reforms restore some trust by making procedures clearer, enforcement fairer, and corruption harder to hide. Administrative capacity improves because responsibility is better assigned, implementation is measured honestly, and officials are rewarded for long-term performance rather than symbolic conflict. Fiscal planning becomes more credible because commitments and revenues move back into a sustainable relationship. Civic coalitions rebuild enough cooperation to support investment in infrastructure, education, workforce development, public health, and security resilience. The result is not an end to conflict. It is a partial restoration of the habits and capacities that keep conflict productive rather than destructive. The difference between these scenarios is not whether problems exist. Problems always exist, The difference is whether institutions can learn. A resilient system detects strain early, tells the truth about trade-offs, distributes burdens in ways many people find tolerable, corrects administrative failures, and keeps political competition bounded by rules. A declining system denies strain until crisis arrives, shifts burdens onto weaker groups, rewards evasion by stronger groups, and treats every institution as an instrument of factional advantage. Rome shows how difficult correction becomes once fiscal strain, legitimacy loss, military pressure, and elite fragmentation reinforce one another. Rome also shows that adaptation can prolong survival and reorganize capacity. The modern question is whether adaptation can be deliberate enough, timely enough, and legitimate enough to prevent deterioration from hardening. Unevenness must remain central. Decline, resilience, and recovery rarely arrive everywhere in the same form. One region may build effective infrastructure, while another loses administrative capacity. One sector innovates, while another becomes brittle. One institution retains public trust, while another suffers deep delegitimization. One community rebuilds civic cooperation, while another fragments. Even Rome's transformation is uneven across empires east and west, across cities and countryside, and across military zones and administrative centers. The modern United States would also experience stress unevenly. Federal structure, regional economies, local governments, private institutions, courts, universities, firms, civic organizations, and state administrations would not all move in the same direction or at the same speed. Unevenness is a danger because it intensifies divergence. It is also an opportunity because islands of competence can become models for repair. A prevention blueprint must therefore operate at the systems level. It cannot treat distrust, fiscal stress, administrative weakness, inequality, and security strain as isolated problems. The aim is to weaken negative feedback loops before they become self-reinforcing. This means improving legitimacy so compliance becomes easier. It means improving administrative competence so public action produces visible results. It means strengthening economic resilience and opportunity so cohesion can be sustained. It also means rebuilding civic norms so political actors, private leaders, and citizens restrain themselves even when exploitation appears available. Prevention is not a single reform. It is a pattern of reinforcement in the opposite direction. The first prevention pillar is legitimacy and accountability. Legitimacy grows when rules are enforced fairly, procedures are transparent, corruption is reduced, elections are credible, and the rule of law is predictable. Fair enforcement does not require perfect enforcement. No system achieves that. Fair enforcement means similar cases are treated similarly. It means powerful actors are not effectively above the law. It means public authority can explain decisions in terms that are more than partisan loyalty. Corruption reduction matters because corruption teaches citizens that rules are masks for private gain. Transparent procedures matter because people are more likely to accept unfavorable outcomes when they understand how decisions were made. Predictable rule of law matters because uncertainty encourages private protection, elite hedging, and political escalation. Accountability also requires restraint. Institutions lose legitimacy when they are used to maximize short-term partisan advantage without regard for long-term trust. Legal power can be abused even when it is formally available. Administrative discretion can be twisted into favoritism. Investigations can become politicized. Oversight can become theater. Election rules can be manipulated for factional gain. A system committed to legitimacy must ask not only whether an action can be done, but whether repeated use of that action leaves the institution credible for everyone. The second prevention pillar is reduced paralysis and improved administrative competence. This begins with clearer lines of responsibility. When everyone shares authority, no one can be held responsible. When every actor has a veto, urgent maintenance may become impossible. Modern governance needs checks and balances, and it also needs the capacity to complete tasks. Better process design helps identify where decisions routinely stall, where permitting or procurement is slow for reasons that do not serve public purpose, where agencies duplicate work, and where legal complexity defeats policy aims. Better implementation capacity requires investing in skilled personnel, data systems, procurement expertise, evaluation, and institutional memory. Policies become real when agencies can deliver them consistently. Incentives must reward long-term performance. Political systems often reward visible conflict more than quiet competence. Media environments can amplify outrage more than maintenance. Budget rules can favor short-term cuts that create long-term costs. Administrative careers can punish risk-taking even when reform is necessary. Prevention requires changing incentives where possible. Public institutions should be judged not only by intentions, but by implementation, durability, fairness, and the capacity to learn from failure. A repaired bridge, a benefit system that works without humiliation, a public health office that retains expertise between crises, and a procurement system that delivers on time all build credibility by turning governance into something people can see. The third prevention pillar is economic resilience and opportunity. A society is more governable when people believe they have a plausible stake in its future. Strong labor market functioning matters because work is not only income. It is attachment, dignity, skill formation, and participation in the common economy. Broad investment pathways matter because opportunity concentrated in a few regions or sectors leaves many communities politically and socially exposed. Regional capacity building matters because national averages can hide local decline. Human capital development matters because education, training, health, and mobility determine whether people can adapt to economic change. Sustainable tax base growth matters because public commitments require a revenue foundation that does not rely only on crisis borrowing or temporary expansion. Economic resilience also reduces the appeal of zero-sum politics. When opportunity is broad, groups may still disagree sharply, but they are less likely to see one another's gain as a permanent loss. When opportunity narrows, every policy fight can become existential. Inequality then feeds fragmentation. Fragmentation blocks investment. And blocked investment worsens inequality. A prevention strategy must connect growth to cohesion. It is not enough for an economy to produce wealth somewhere. The question is whether enough households, regions, and communities experience the system as open enough, fair enough, and future-oriented enough to support shared obligations. The fourth prevention pillar is civic and cultural norms that support cooperation. Institutions are not only laws and offices. They are habits of behavior. Truthful public communication matters because a society cannot solve problems it cannot describe honestly. Institutional restraint matters because rules can be damaged by actors who exploit loopholes while claiming formal legality. Responsible elite conduct matters because influential people set expectations for what is acceptable. Public-oriented organizational governance matters because firms, media institutions, universities, nonprofits, unions, religious organizations, professional associations, and civic groups all shape whether people trust common life. Civic norms do not require agreement on ideology. They require a minimum commitment to reality, rules, and mutual restraint. Political leaders can criticize institutions without trying to destroy confidence in every unfavorable result. Media organizations can investigate wrongdoing without making permanent outrage their only business model. Business leaders can pursue profit while recognizing that rule of law, infrastructure, education, and social stability are not outside markets. Citizens can argue fiercely while still rejecting political violence, dehumanization, and deliberate falsehood. These norms are difficult to measure. Their absence is easy to feel. When they weaken, formal institutions must carry more weight than they were designed to bear. Every prevention strategy involves trade-offs. Reform shifts burdens and creates winners and losers. It faces entrenched resistance. It requires credible transition planning. Anti-corruption reforms can threaten networks that benefit from opacity. Fiscal reforms can require taxes, spending changes, eligibility adjustments, and reordered priorities. Administrative streamlining can reduce some protections if done carelessly, or it can be blocked by actors who benefit from delay. Infrastructure investment can impose local costs even when national benefits are real. Defense industrial renewal can require long-term commitments that compete with domestic spending. Economic development can help some regions faster than others. Civic reforms can be dismissed as partisan if they are not applied consistently. Credible reform, therefore, requires honesty about cost. A society cannot rebuild capacity by pretending that every group can pay less, receive more, and sacrifice nothing. Nor can it rebuild trust by imposing burdens only on those with the least power to resist. Transition planning matters because people and institutions organize their lives around existing rules. Sudden change can produce backlash even when reform is necessary. Durable reform usually needs phased implementation, visible fairness, competent administration, and institutions able to survive political turnover. The test is not whether a reform sounds virtuous in the abstract. The test is whether it can endure contact with incentives, opposition, complexity, and time. This is a method with responsibilities on all sides. Public officials and institutions have a responsibility to provide transparency so citizens can understand decisions and detect abuse. They have a responsibility to build credible long-term fiscal planning so promises and resources do not drift apart indefinitely. They have a responsibility to enforce the rule of law consistently, especially when powerful actors are involved. They have a responsibility to maintain institutions before failure becomes spectacular. They have a responsibility to implement policy effectively, because repeated failure destroys trust even when goals are popular. Public authority must also preserve the distinction between governing and campaigning. Campaigning seeks victory. Governing must preserve the system in which future victories and defeats remain legitimate. Private and elite responsibilities matter as well. Institutional resilience does not depend only on elected officials. Business leaders, investors, media executives, professional elites, donors, civic organizers, university leaders, local notables, and ordinary citizens shape incentives. Conduct norms matter. Organizational governance matters. Civic participation matters. Investment in shared capacity matters. So does restraint from exploiting institutional weakness for zero-sum advantage. A firm that profits from regulatory loopholes while depending on public infrastructure is making a civic choice, not only a market choice. A media actor that monetizes distrust while relying on the freedoms and protections of a stable constitutional order is making a civic choice. Political elites who delegitimize procedures whenever they lose are making a civic choice. Resilience depends on enough influential actors deciding that preservation of the system is worth more than the next tactical win. Rome helps clarify this through the idea of adaptive resilience. A resilient system must raise resources without destroying the base from which resources come. It must command loyalty without relying constantly on coercion. It must adapt administration without paralyzing coordination. It must absorb outsiders and new social realities without surrendering sovereignty or losing the ability to enforce common rules. Rome succeeds at some tasks for long stretches and fails at others, especially in the Western Empire as pressures accumulate. Its reforms show intelligence and flexibility. Its difficulties show how adaptation can become costly, complex, and dependent on bargains that gradually reduce central control. Modern adaptive resilience requires different tools because modern states are not ancient empires. The United States has elections, courts, constitutional rights, central banking, public debt markets, mass media, professional bureaucracies, global supply chains, advanced science, digital communication, and technologically sophisticated military forces. It also has a public whose consent is organized through democratic legitimacy rather than imperial acclamation, dynasty, court politics, or army loyalty. This changes what resilience means. A modern state must maintain trust through legal procedures, electoral credibility, rights protection, public performance, and accountable administration. It must manage fiscal stress through taxation, borrowing, monetary policy, growth, and political negotiation. It must manage security through alliances, deterrence, intelligence, industry, and diplomacy. It must manage cohesion in a plural society where legitimacy depends partly on fair inclusion of people who differ by region, class, religion, race, ideology, and origin. Rome cannot teach a timetable. It cannot tell anyone that a modern state has a fixed number of years before crisis. It cannot offer a one-to-one institutional match. There is no Roman equivalent of a modern constitutional presidency, an independent central bank, a mass electorate, a national media ecosystem, a professionalized federal bureaucracy, or judicially enforced constitutional rights. Rome also cannot directly resolve trade-offs between liberty and security, national power and global interdependence, local autonomy and federal authority, public debt and investment, or information disorder in open societies. It can clarify mechanisms. It cannot replace analysis of modern conditions. Several analogy breakers must remain visible because they shape possible outcomes. Nuclear deterrence changes the meaning of great power war. Global trade changes the meaning of supply, dependence, and prosperity. Global finance changes the meaning of debt, currency, and fiscal crisis. Mass literacy changes how legitimacy is argued and contested. Scientific capacity changes disease response, agriculture, engineering, communication, and military power. Modern medicine changes demographic resilience and public expectations. Industrial logistics changes the speed and scale of mobilization. Digital communication changes the spread of information, rumor, coordination, and distrust. Democratic legitimacy changes the basis on which citizens accept authority and reject it. These factors do not make decline impossible. They make it different, and they broaden the range of pathways crisis can take. The most responsible synthesis is therefore a small set of interlocking causal themes. Legitimacy determines whether people accept authority without constant coercion. Fiscal capacity determines whether the state can fund commitments, invest in maintenance, and respond to shocks. Military effectiveness determines whether security commitments are credible and whether external pressure remains manageable. Administrative coordination determines whether decisions become implemented reality. Elite incentives determine whether influential actors preserve common rules or exploit weakness. Civic cohesion determines whether burdens can be shared without each question becoming existential. External pressure tests all of these at once. No single theme explains Rome by itself. No single theme forecasts the United States by itself. The danger lies in their interaction. If legitimacy weakens, fiscal measures become harder to sustain. If fiscal capacity weakens, military readiness and public investment suffer. If military or security failures accumulate, legitimacy declines. If administrative coordination fails, even well-funded policies disappoint. If elites evade burdens or capture institutions, civic cohesion erodes. If civic cohesion erodes, reform becomes harder. If external pressure rises while all of this is happening, the system has less room for error. The opposite is also true. Repair can become cumulative. Fair enforcement can rebuild trust. Trust can improve compliance. Better compliance can lower enforcement costs. Lower enforcement costs can free resources for maintenance. Visible maintenance can strengthen legitimacy. More competent administration can make fiscal sacrifice more acceptable because people see results. Broader opportunity can increase willingness to share risks. Responsible elite conduct can reduce cynicism. Civic norms can make political loss bearable. Security competence can preserve confidence without militarizing public life. In that healthier loop, institutions do not become perfect. They become more capable of correction. Several open questions remain worth carrying forward as you think about early warning and prevention. Which early signals matter most? Declining trust in elections, widening regional divergence, rising fiscal inflexibility, administrative failure, elite norm breaking, weakening alliance credibility, or reduced willingness to share burdens? Which reforms are durable enough to survive political turnover, media outrage, budget stress, and organized resistance? And which modern analogy breakers make Roman lessons less effective, while which Roman mechanisms remain relevant despite all the differences? The final lesson is neither certainty nor panic. Rome shows that powerful institutions can adapt for a long time, and that adaptation can be real. Rome also shows that adaptation can carry unresolved vulnerabilities forward. Decline can be slow, uneven, and partly hidden by inherited prestige. It can appear as the gradual loss of maintenance, the normalization of distrust, the narrowing of fiscal room, the fragmentation of authority, and the retreat of elites and communities into private advantage. But conditional decline also means conditional agency. Feedback loops can deepen, and they can be weakened. Institutions can lose legitimacy, and they can regain some of it through fairness, competence, restraint, and visible performance. Public systems can be neglected bit by bit, and they can also be repaired bit by bit. Rome does not tell modern America what must happen. It warns what can happen when legitimacy, capacity, cohesion, and external pressure cease to be managed together. The future remains open precisely because institutions are human arrangements. They do not fall by gravity. They can decay slowly, adapt unevenly, or recover through deliberate reform. Sources' standard reference overviews on the crisis of the 3rd century. The late Roman army, foederati, barbarian invasions, taxation, poverty, and the fall of the Western Roman Empire supplied the core chronology and institutional background. Britannica's discussion of Diocletian's domestic reforms clarified the tetrarchy and the late imperial reorganization of civil and military authority. A National Institutes of Health-hosted review on climate change, agriculture, and the Roman economy informed the sections on cooling, harvest stress, and environmental pressure. The Mises Institute essay on inflation and the fall of the Roman Empire informed the discussion of debasement, price controls, and the move toward taxes in kind. A Heritage Foundation essay on civic virtue and Rome's decline, together with an Epoch magazine piece on urban abandonment in late antiquity, informed the sections on civic fragmentation and shrinking cities. For disease and demographic stress, the lecture also drew on a standard reference overview of the Plague of Cyprian and a recent review on plague and climate links. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.